The following is a production of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary, visit us online at gpts.edu.
And I'll maybe ask any of you if you can help me identify birth form, but no one will be responsible because it was Eric's turn tonight. He has somehow or another appeared. Tatoi soi grapho elpizo elfame prosa en take. These things I write, or am writing to you, hoping to come to you en take in moment or in quickness, speedily or readily. The grapho, of course, is the present active indicative, first person singular of grapho. Piso is a present active participle, nominative, masculine singular, elpizon, hoping. Elphane is an aorist, second aorist, active infinitive, and there are no other verbs in there as I can see. So he's telling him why he's writing. And these things refer back to the preceding comments. Namely, what he's told them about officers, bishops, and deacons, and perhaps also what he's told them about men and women and their respective roles in the congregation, at least back to the second and third chapter. And you can look at our commentary, and it will give you a note indicating where the Tauta has been referring to what precedes. And you'll see that I've given middle page 178 a number of references. And particularly, I ask you to look at 4.11, which comes on later, and 6.2 for further treatment of the question of what Tauta refers to, considering the pattern in the cross epistle. It usually refers to that which is immediately preceding or precedes at least before this. Now, he's writing these things with an expectation, hope, hoping to come to you quickly. But he's really writing, and that's what he gives as his major premise, but his, which really turns out to be the minor premise. What he's really writing them, even though he's hoping to come to them quickly, is because he contemplates the fact that he's going to be delayed. And so you find that in the next verse. But let's just look at other words in this verse before we move on. I'm writing these things to you. It's obviously a direct address to Timothy. It's his expectation, our hope is laid out, elpizon, hoping, proste entake, with the verb elphane indicating what he's hoping to come. And by the way, elphane is from erkomai, as you know. But then he tells why he is really writing, because he's, although he's hoped to do one thing, he more likely expects that a certain else will happen, and that certain thing he expects will happen, he tells us in the next verse. And raduna duno hina edes pros de en poiko theu strefestai. Etes, etis, estin, ecclesia, theu, zontos, stulos, kai, hedramo, hedraoma, tes, aletheas. And of course, what he's writing them is with this possible expectation, if I am being delayed, or I'm delaying, it's a passive which indicates an active meaning, but it's present active subjunctive actually here, present active subjunctive because of the aeon. The aeon demands a subjunctive. So, but if I am delayed, or I'm being delayed, in order that you may know, and here we have hina edes, and that's a present Let's see, how is that? The perfect, it's actually a perfect subjunctive, perfect active subjunctive from oida, and it's third singular. But if, in order that you may know, it's actually second singular, you may know. So he's still addressing Timothy, but I think we mustn't press the you there, because we'll see he begins to use plurals as he goes on later on. But in order that you may know, you may recognize or be acquainted with how, and here's the how statement. He's writing to express how they ought to live. How it is necessary, it is appropriate day. That's an, as you know, a special word that she only used in the third singular in most cases. How you should live or conduct yourself on a strephesthai, or that you may know how you ought to act or live, with a passive form with an active meaning here, because that's a passive infinitive, present passive infinitive, but with understood as an active meaning, how you ought to live, how it is necessary to live. But then he puts it in the house of God first, in oikotheo, and then he elaborates on that house of God by having a hetis, which is a special kind of a relative pronoun with a tis, giving kind of a more open-ended phenomenon to it. That which is. And then he explains it further, in ecclesia, the church of Theou, of God, zontos, living God. And then further he describes it in what its calling and activity should be. Stulos, that's something that you hold something up. Pillar, P-I-L-L-A-R, a pillow, put your head on, but a pillar, upright, a thing for a roof or a patio or something. And the pillar and foundation, although there are other meanings that are sometimes suggested, these are words that I think can probably best translate that. Foundation is a hapax legomena, means what? Occurs only one time. And this is one time in the New Testament. It's only here. It's known elsewhere in Greek, but it means foundation or mainstay. But can be something you're building upon, or it can be something that's holding something up, like you have a wire on the side of a telephone pole, or a side of a mast of a ship, or things like that. But I think foundation is best here. We'll get to that in just a minute. But it is the pillar and foundation of the truth, tes aletheos. And then he comes to what he wants to confess. Before we see that, let's remember that braduno is a present subjunctive active, first plural. Eides is a perfect subjunctive active, perfect active subjunctive, second singular, oida. And de is third singular, present active indicative. On a strephesthai is a present passive infinitive. Estin, third singular, fourth, present active indicative. And I think that's all the verbs in tongues there. And then notice what he wants to say as he comes finally to, before he gives us this poetic, creedal statement. He gives us, Kai homologumenos, mega, confessedly great. And it's been translated all sorts of different ways in the New Testament, because of what it wants to do is to say this exceeds in any way what one might expect. But its most literal translation is to say confessedly great. Is the to mysterion, the mystery, the revelation understood? The revelation of godliness, which is incarnate in the person and work of Christ, and therefore we pick up on that godliness in what follows. All right, let's go back and see what else we need to understand here. The Hina clause indicates why he's writing. The Aeon clause indicates more surely but not certainly the reason for that. He may be delayed. And the Hina indicates what he wants him to do, know how he should conduct himself in the house of God. But then he says the house of God, or the household of God, place in which, and the people that are in that place. So oikos in two different senses. It seems like it's talking about a building, because you have the fixtures of a building later on, stulos and hedraikomai. But when you read through it, when it talks about the living God being present there, and it's being concerned for the truth, you get the impression he's also talking about the church as it lives actively in an entity which he describes picturesquely in this way as the pillar and the ground of the truth. But anyway, it's the house or household of God, which he further describes as the church, ecclesia, of God, but then he describes him more actively and meaningfully. He's the living God, who no building can contain, but who vivifies, gives life and vitality to anyone who are in that and members of that church. And furthermore, then he describes the church where it be active. And if I can do it picturesquely for you, I'll do it this way. I'll take an English Bible, and I'll put my hand like this. Foundation and pillow of truth. So the purpose for the existence of the church is to have a foundation and a pillow underneath that which it shall proclaim. And of course, the truth is just another way of speaking of reliability, accuracy, and communication of the good news of Jesus Christ and all the teachings of God, which is here called simply the truth. So pillar, the foundation of the truth. And so he's calling the church where they live, and those that live in it, belonging to God who is alive and ever living and that gives life to us, and which is called to be the foundation and the pillar of the truth. So, that's why we should walk well and live well in this house of God, because we're living in the temple or church of God with the living God, and we call on to have a message and activity. And so he goes on to say that confessedly great is this mystery of godliness. He's reaching back, of course, to what they should be in that church, but most of all looking forward to talk about what we have heard, believed, because it has been revealed to us by God. So we confess it, join with God in saying it is confessedly great. But we're confessing something he has revealed to us. But mysterion is used in the Bible, the New Testament, not as a mystery, as we think of mysterion being a mystery, that, you know, you might get insight to, as you read the last pages of this mystery, find out what the riddle was or the secret thing. No, it's something that we haven't been able to know beforehand. We're not able to know as simply as rational creatures by our human intellect, but that God must reveal or make known to us. And therefore it is a public declaration of that which we could not know if he has not revealed it to us. And it's described that way always in the New Testament as a mysterion, a mystery. A mystery that God alone knows the outcome of, and God alone makes public the situation of that mystery. Any questions about what we looked at so far?
Yes. Dr. Wright, what is the form of homologomenos?
That is an adverb.
Okay.
That's what the nos ending is on the ending. So it's a confessedly. Let me just see if I have that documented here for you. The New Testament hapax contains both the positive aspect of agreement by all which confessedly, and the negative aspect of that which is beyond question or denial, undeniably. But it, with the ending on it, you know that it has this adverbial significance to it. All right. Now, that brings us then to this great statement he gives us. And you need to look at the statement. We're going to take its component parts and see what we can learn from it. It begins with a relative. And the relative can be one of three things. We'll come back to that in a minute. It can either be os, ho, or theos. Os, ho, or theos. If you have a Greek New Testament, look at the footnote. You see, if you have this kind of Greek New Testament, but even if you have another kind, you ought to be able to see it. You see at the bottom it says hos, and then it gives a number of uncial form or manuscripts, all of them having an asterisk, or at least the first three having an asterisk after it or above it. What does the asterisk mean? Give you a little bit of textual criticism here. It's all free. I'll look for it. What does the asterisk mean above the letters? Okay, that's what you need to learn. Very important if you're going to use information at the bottom of the page. The asterisk means that there are several forms of the text at this one point, but that the one for which it is quoted is the original hand. In other words, when the text is, when you look at the text, it will, let's just use this one. This will have hos, I won't worry about anything except the rough reading. And you'll find that someone has written above it, so let's just see what we have here. Someone has written above it, a second hand is written above it. I don't know what the first hand wrote. Maybe this, maybe the asterisk is the first hand. And the second hand is written above it this. I'm sorry this is not coming out very well. Theos. So you have hos and theos in the same manuscript. With the difference being, this is the original hand. Ah, come on. It's not doing very well. This is the original hand, right there. And this is the second hand. Now, what you need to know, and this is one thing that's not taught well enough in textual criticism, a guy who writes a book on textual criticism ought to have a separate chart. The trouble is he'd have to do it for almost every manuscript, in which he indicates the century in which he believes the hand is found. So this hand is the original date of the Alpha manuscript. This hand is whatever date he has presumed as he's examined all the ways in which this scribe who's gone over the manuscript again and made these changes here and in a number of places, and maybe more than one of them doing that, but at least at this place, what century that scribe lived in. And of course you determine it in various ways, and that's just telling you the outcome, not how you go through it. So, we notice in the footnote that at least the first three unsealed manuscripts, Aleph, A, and C, are all in the first hand. Okay? Now, let's just help me. Tell me how many unsealed manuscripts have the reading ho?
One.
One. And what is it?
Yid.
That's right. Come on.
You have a blue one there.
Okay, thank you. I was just going through them. Ah, yes. Lovely.
And that's only read by D. And not very many others.
So you can see it's parentheses 061. That means that you probably have to look at them. Maybe some uncertainty. Maybe they're not sure what it's supposed to call. I'm not sure what that is. And then you have all these Italian manuscripts, special form of Italian translations, with rays indication to indicate various manuscripts. And then you have the Vulgate, VG, and then you have a number of church fathers beginning, listing them in chronological order, from the earliest to the latest. And you have Severian, Theodotus, Ankara, Ankara, Torinus, Rome, Hilary, Ambrosiaster, Pelagius, Augustine, and so on. So they read,
let's read.
And then you have a reading that reads Theos. That reading is read by what are the first uncials that are mentioned?
Olive.
Okay. Olive and what else?
ACD.
ACD. Now, how many of them have a raised number?
Only three.
Only three.
Well, A has a raised letter. I don't know what that means.
Raised number.
It's a raised letter. It's a little C.
Oh, that's because this manuscript has its own code, and so rather than using 1, 2, 3, use ABC. Never mind.
All right.
Okay. So 2C2. Is that right? Is that the way it goes? And what about D?
2.
And 2 also. Huh? And there are several others, of course. For example, you have the BYZ, that means Byzantium. It means the manuscripts that are behind, by and large, the King James Bible and the Textus Receptus of Erasmus. And then the various lectionaries and the Vulgate and other Slavic and other translation, and then a number of church fathers. Now, the question is, what is the proper reason? Here's the way you need to think of it, first of all. Hos is used to designate, because the masculine is singular, it's used to designate someone who is not referred to in this document, and either is implied by the material in the six standards, or was referred to in a portion that is in larger than this hymn that is our creedal statement that is quoted. And who might that possibly be?
That was not mentioned.
Who is
Jesus?
Jesus. So this refers to Jesus or Christ or so on. So that's understood. This refers to Jesus, Christ, whether he's referred to Christ or as Jesus. And you see that there's no statement in the text immediately before that which he's in view. Unless it's simply referred to God, as God, which is a possibility, but it's certainly a God who is seen to be Jesus Christ because he's manifested in the flesh. So it's probably more likely referring to Jesus Christ. It probably doesn't go back to verse 13, which is the last reference to Christ Jesus. So it either refers to him as understood because of six items while I reference to him, or because this is part of a larger entity out of which this document is being taken. We don't have the answer to all that. It is just a possibility. This is used because it seems to be the right thing to have in the text to refer back to the immediate antecedent. And what would be the antecedent if you had a ho? Ho would be neuter, singular, nominative. What?
Mysterium.
Yes, mysterium, because it's ta mysterion. So that's neuter, this is neuter, and so the person said, well, that's what it ought to be, because they're referring directly back to the mystery of godliness. But the trouble is, you don't have enough evidence for this one. I mean, I don't want to tell people that's the right reading when it only has D, original hand. So the other
people said, well, what it must be is it must be God.
So the way to introduce this is to say God was manifested in the flesh. He was vindicated in the spirit. He was seen of angels and so on. But now we need to deal with the data as we find it in the references. And let me just read from an evangelical source, a man who's named Bruce Metzger, who's defended the various things that he's teaching at Princeton that were precious to evangelicals. But he's been very well known and working in this area. And here's what he says. The reading which, on the basis of external evidence, the external evidence is that these seem to be written in the document before these were. Because that's the second hand, this is the first hand. So you see it on the face of the text. And in the old uncials, which is the oldest document beside the papyri document, that on the basis of external evidence and transcriptional probability. In other words, if you put these three documents, you put these three documents and you write them all out, hos, ho, and theos, and try to arrange them in some sort of order. This one leads to that one, and that one leads to that one, or this one leads to one of these and then to one of those, or however the order may be, it could be arranged in several ways. Which one of these best explains the other? So he's arguing that external evidence is in favor of Hoss and probably explaining the others, but let's hear that. Best explains the rise of the others. And he says the one that wins in that case from his perspective and the men who worked with him producing this document was Hoss. Now why do they say that? Let's hear him state the evidence. First of all, it is supported by the earliest and best uncials. A. Aleph, which he mentioned, you ought to look at. He has more documentation here than we have in the footnote. He has A, and then this asterisk right here, but then he has beside it VID, which means see this. Look at it yourself. A, that, C, and others. As well as by, and he gives a list of some other manuscripts that are contained. And he lists them rather thoroughly here. Furthermore, since the neuter relative pronoun ho must have arisen as a scribal correction of hos, they say, if you put all these together, you're going to get this from that. Why so? Because the Greek scribe said you shouldn't have a hos after to musterion, you should have a ho. So this reading best explains that reading. You had host there and you read it, you say, host, what's it supposed to go back to? What doesn't go back to Mysterion? Because that's feminine. It doesn't, no, it doesn't go back to Mysterion, that's neuter. It doesn't go back to godliness, that's feminine. It's got to be changed. So that's the way he's arguing that. Now, whether it's true, it seems most probable. That's what works for. Furthermore, since the neuter relative pronoun ho must arisen as a scribal correction of hos, to bring the relative into concord with mysterion, the witnesses which read ho, D asterisk, IT, and the various manuscripts, the Vulgate, Ambrosiaster, and so on, also indirectly presuppose hos as the earlier reading. So you say you can take all the data you have here from the manuscript testimony and you can subsume it under this because this all points back to that. This is earlier, this is the next thing. Now we've got to get to dealing with the other. The Textus Receptus reads Theos. Erasmus text, King James translation, and so on. With Aleph E, Aleph E I have here, what is that? That's not what we have in the text. Aleph, well, he must be another situation in which you read it and designate different. This corrector is of the 12th century. So he's saying the first corrector that you have, for this reading, which is Aleph, Aleph, which he puts as an E rather than two. I don't know why he does that. He says that corrector goes back to the 12th century. Now, if you presume that Aleph was written somewhere in about the 4th century, that means that this reading in this old manuscript came about 8 centuries later. And that's why he's arguing that there's a better external basis for it. So the Textus Receptus reads Theos with Aleph E, or Aleph second hand. This corrector is of the 12th century. He goes on to say, thus no uncial in the first hand earlier than the 8th or 9th century supports Theos. And what he says is the 8th or 9th century, he takes the C as a document which he says comes from the 8th or 9th century. So you have C, it's coming from the 8th or 9th century. So he's saying the earliest one we have for a real early uncial is the 12th century hand. 12th century, mind you. And the earliest one we have beyond that is this Aleph, this of C, which he says is the 8th or 9th. I'm sorry, it's not coming through very well. Or 9th century. So he's saying, if you take textual versions and talk about age, talking about which is the earliest, then you have all ancient versions presuppose post or whole, and no patristic writer prior to the last third of the 4th century testifies to the reading of Theos. So all of ancient versions presuppose post or whole. So you can look back here and see that we don't have any ancient versions testifying to Theos until you get down to the Vulgate, which is much, much later than the more ancient versions. So he says, all ancient versions presuppose post or whole, and no patristic writer prior to the last third of the 4th century testifies to the reading Theos. The reading Theos arose either accidentally through the mistaking of Hos as Theos. Now look at here. I've written it on the board. This is the way you write a capital Omicron. This is the way you write a capital Sigma when it's a final letter. And the capitals that go back to this far. Not as this. Oh dear.
The black one now.
The black one, okay. Aye. Not as this, but as that. You see that? Mm-hmm. Now, this would be a normal way to write this in an uncial manuscript where all the letters are capital. But he says it's possible to confuse this for that. Because the only difference between this and this is the bar across the middle, which makes this not an omicron, but a theta.
Theos.
Theos.
And it's written that way because they abbreviate the names of God, save space, and they indicate the abbreviation by putting a bar across the top. And he said if it was written too lightly or the person didn't have very good eyesight, he could see this to mean that. Are you having something getting on you back there? Oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Be careful.
The other one right here.
We may have to move out of here and have a break in it. Get something. But anyway, so this could be read as that. And that may be the argument of that. That's what one thing he says. And the other thing is this. Either accidentally through the misreading of Paul as Theos, or deliberately either to supply a substantive for the following six verbs, or less promptly to provide greater dogmatic precision. So you could say, well, we don't want to just have a ho there, a ho, so we don't know who this is about. Well, let's tell people who it's about. It's about Theos. So I commend you to read that on your own. I'm not trying to twist anybody's arm about textual criticism, but at least like to show why I think in this one place the reading hos is to be preferred to ho or to Theos. And it's because of which one best substantiates the other. Now, any questions about that?
No parallel passages in which hos is used the same way?
Oh yeah, there are parallel passages in which hos is used, deleted or something, but I haven't documented them, found them by the way. I'd have to look them up in the concordance. But there are hoses that introduce the following statements. Yes, that's no doubt. That's not a problem for the Greek language or the New Testament. But good question to ask. All right, so we're either saying God or who, and I would commend us to best understand the matter by saying one is who, and the who refers back to Jesus Christ. If you want to read the King James and take Theos, that's your option. But you have to realize what you're doing when you do that. You are reaching back to, remember how late he said it was that the Theos came into existence. In the Fathers, it came to the last third of the 4th century, and in the Greek manuscripts, there was nothing earlier than the 8th or 9th century. That is in the Uncials. It may have been in some other manuscripts, but not in the Uncials. And the ancient versions all presuppose false or whole. You got those three considerations that you need to think about when you look at things. Well, I thought at least one time you should have a little extra criticism, and I thought this would be the time. But now let's look at the document itself. All we can say is it's a very highly arranged or schematic statement that it seems to me is made to be like that. And so it's either some creedal document or some hymnic document or something that's to be poetic. And I'm not going to try to decide between those. I'll choose, but notice what you have. You have the hos, which serves as the introduction to all the verbs. Who? Hello? It is. I'm fine. In the areas you have an aorist, passive, indicative, verb in every case. Every one of those are in that format. And there's just no doubt about that. Aorist, passive, indicative, third singular. You can just look down the end and see you got they. Maybe root changes or stem changes in those, but and then you have every one of them followed with one exception by an M. So ensarche and pneumati, not an M before angelos, and ethnesen, and cosmo and doxa. So it's followed by a dative form with or without the N. five cases with an N, one case because the writer felt it would be more apt to translate and express the truth by not using an N. And then followed by a noun in the dative tense. So you've got aorist passive verb, usually an N, and usually a noun in the dative tense. And so it seemed to me it's just absolutely assured that this is some special hymnic or creedal or poetic statement. Now the question arises, how shall we understand it? And here's where I'd like to go. I'd like to take the time tonight to give you about four or five ways of understanding it, so you won't have to go through that yourself. First of all, Alford, which wrote that four-volume work, you know, an old English commentary, and wrote it on a Greek text, Alford's comment on this matter is to say that the six stanzas refer to Jesus' earthly ministry, with the last stanza referring to his ascension. So he says he became incarnate, he was vindicated by the Spirit, he was seen by angels, he was proclaimed to the nations or the peoples, he was believed on in the world, and finally he was taken up or ascended into glory. Problem is a little bit, you can read it that way, but vindicated by the Spirit seems to me ought to come in sections in which he's talking about his proclamation, because that's when the vindication takes place. It actually took place in his resurrection, but it was seen in the time after his resurrection in vindicating what he claimed to be in the book. But that's one way, Alfred said that. Now, Barrett, in his commentary, takes the same position. There's a chronology going from 1 to 6. But he takes it as referring to post-resurrection times about Jesus, which I think is just not very likely, because you can't refer to the first item, the post-resurrection item. I didn't take the time to look and see how he did that again, but that's the way he did it. And the last item, he said, is post-resurrection because it refers to the coming again. But the trouble is, as I recall it, the New Testament doesn't use the word received in glory to talk about the coming again. It talks about that as what happens before the coming again, but not at the coming again. So I think Alford may have a plausibility. Most people have not fought it because they've seen other problems in it. And by the way, this is all given to you, all laid out in Gundry's famous work on the form of this doctrine. Let me just point you to the bibliological material where you can see where that is. It's a special article, as I recall, R.H. Gundry, The Form, Meaning, and Background of the Hymn Quoted in 1 Timothy 3:16. In the work Apostolic History and the Gospel, edited by Gass and Martin, Grand Rapids, 1970, for about 20 pages, 203 to 22. That's the first view. The second view, held by at least four men, Locke, von Soden, Scott, and Falconer, are those who see the quotation as two strophes of three lines each, and also take them to be chronologically arranged. And by the way, that's the way it seems almost to be laid out in the Greek Testament, which he uses. But you have a different form. You don't. Do you have a blue cover on yours, or you have a red one too?
Yes.
Red.
Anybody have a blue Nestle?
Yeah, you do, don't you?
No. Oh, you don't have a Nestle, do you? All right. Well, anyway, the Nestle has them laid out as two stanzas. But this one, you see, seems to have it as 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But it shows that the two documents are very similar, but not always identical. In this case, they vary in terms of their layout. But these men say that there are two strophes of three lines each. So you have three lines, which are one statement,
strophe, as they call it, and the three lines are the next. And the format suggests either that the strophes are three lines each, or two lines with a third line as a refrain, in each case. So sometimes they say you go one, two, three, and sometimes you go one, two, and then reiterate it with a third step. And they say all but Falconer relate the first stroke to Christ's life on earth, the second to his life on earth through the church and its proclamation. So you have manifested in the flesh, vindicated in the spirit, and seen of angels. That's his life on earth. His life after that is proclaimed to the nations, believed on in the world, and received in the glory. So that would talk about his post-resurrection phenomenon. Now that comes close to being right, because it's virtually identical to the three strophe, two lines phenomenon. But in my judgment, the difference is that it doesn't recognize how contrasting and therefore how related to one another the first and second, third and fourth, and fifth and sixth are. And we'll get to that in just a minute.
Yeah.
Questions? No? All right. For example, Falconer says that there are parallels between 1 and 6, 4 and 5, and 2 and, let's see, 1, 5, 4, 3, and 2, 6. But they're quite remote, and I don't know why they should be taken over the other. But the majority of interpreters, except Gundry himself, who's taken his new stance, from the most critical to the most evangelical or Calvinistic, or however, whatever their style, Irmasons or Lutherans, Dominicans, Consmans, or critical Lutherans, Kellys, and Anglican, Ritterbos, Dutch Reformed speakers, the French Roman Catholic, and so on. They say that what is happening is that you've got a situation in which you have two stanzas grouped together. You have two, two, and two. So you have three strophes, each of two stanzas apiece. And they believe the matter is set up in a contrast between flesh and spirit, the ending words, of course, sarki, pneuma, Mati, angels, angelos, and ethnosin, and nations, or peoples, and then between cosmos, and doxe, the world, and glory. And if that is the case, which I think it may well be, you have this antithesis of earthly and heavenly. Sarx, pneuma, earthly and heavenly. Then you have a switch, heavenly, earthly, and angels and nation. And then you have a switch again, world and doxa. So that if you put the thing out on a chart as having 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, it goes like this. You do 1, 2, and then by the time you get here, you've come from here to here, and there to there. And then when you go back like this. So what it's talked about is being a double chiasma. So you got across there, and across understood in the middle, and across here. I'm not sure that I've laid them out quite correctly. I think this should be coming here, and then this one here. And finally this one here. But you can understand what we're doing here when we're doing it that way. So a double chiasma, in other words, actually a triple chiasma where you have three crossovers. One in the middle, actually being the crossover point. Let me get this straight. You have one to here, and then one to here. So you really have a double chiasma, with the middle one making the flip. And what I mean by that is it goes from earth, from flesh to spirit, then turns back around and goes from angel, which would be spirit, to nation, which would be earth, then comes back again, around again, and goes from earth or cosmos to glory. So it's a double chiasm. Now what I think is being expressed in this, and I put it in my textbook by saying AB, BA, AB. If you line that up, you can notice that you're going two different X's there. The first of the three couplets presents Christ's work accomplished. He became incarnate, and he was vindicated. Incarnate in the flesh, and he came by the Holy Spirit. Then you see his work being made known, and it is done by being seen by the angels and being proclaimed to the nations. That's the middle two. The last two, his work acknowledged. It is believed on in the world, and by being received in the glory, he's being acknowledged by the King of Kings, his Father, by being taken up in the glory. Or to put it another way, it is the revelation of Christ in the first trophy of two lines. It is the proclamation of Christ, and it is the reception of Christ. Believers believe on him to receive him. Heaven receives him by accepting him and receiving the glory. Revelation, proclamation, and reception. Now I think that's the way to do it. The only one I should comment on further is Gundry. And Gundry says, here's what we should understand it. He says, the first and last standards are to be seen in relationship to one another. We have manifested in the flesh and received in the glory. So he says, what he begins with and what he ends with are the two posts, as it were. And then the middle two are two things that are harmonious. He is vindicated in the spirit and seen of angels. That's all heavenly matters. And he's proclaimed in the world and believed on in the world. And that seems possible too. Except why break apart the other contrast book we have of taking the first one and last one together? So there you are. That's the tray of offerings. You can take whichever one you think is most faithful, does the best justice to the text. But I'm just telling you that I'm opting for three strophes of two standards apiece. Now, before we go on, let's see if you have any questions about that. All right. Now, what are we going to look at? Well, first of all, we're going to look at the Falso Theos, which we've already done. The only thing I can add to what I've told you is that one of the interesting commentators on this passage, the Christus Hymnus, a man named W. Metzger, who lives in and writes in Germany. He believes that there are a number of pieces of this hymn scattered throughout 1 Timothy. And on page 184, he comments, he believes it's in 2 chapter 2 through 6, 1 chapter 115, 3 chapter 316, and of course, then the 6th chapter 14b to 16. Now, whether it's true or not, I don't know. I must say it's the most clever working with the passage that I've seen. I mean, you have to give them an A-plus for cleverness and ingenuity. Whether it has any merit in fact or reality, I'm not sure. But he says, if you do it that way, then you can see the antecedent in a situation where Christ has been named, and that's why he takes that as preceding. And you can see what he does. He takes 115 as the preceding comment, and as you know, 115 was said, Christ Jesus came to the world to save sinners, and then you pick up on that right away and say, here's how he did that, who was manifested in the flesh and so on. And therefore, you got the antecedent right there. Christ Jesus came to the world to save sinners. And then you have the Christ Jesus there, and then you say, who? And it goes all over verse 16 in chapter 3. But I wasn't fully persuaded. I was intrigued. I thought it was a wonderful attempt. At the end, I just wasn't sure that was right. All right, let's look at what we have now. We've looked enough at how you structured and so on.
That's right.
Yes?
One question about the things indicated are justified in the Spirit.
Yes.
Which specific event is he talking about here?
I think the way we understand that is his resurrection. And the reason I think it is the resurrection is because resurrection is referred to with reference to Christ in the 8th chapter of Romans, and more particularly, in the closest statement to this is that wonderful statement in Romans 1. And I think you need to turn to that first. We're actually getting ahead of manifested in this flesh, but we'll come back to that momentarily. You look at Romans 1, and you see where it says, he set apart for the gospel of God, verse 1, the end of the verse, which he promised beforehand to his prophets and the Holy Scriptures concerning his son who was descended from David according to the flesh and was declared to be the Son of God. So that which he claimed to be in answering both in his trial and in terms of confessing that the Apostle Peter had made the right confession. So he's acknowledged this several times and could also acknowledge it when he argues, how can he be David's son and David's Lord? That's another way in which he's arguing the same thing. Concerning his son who was descended from David according to the flesh, was declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead. And when he says by his resurrection from the dead and precedes that by saying according to the Spirit of holiness, then I think you have the answer to why he's saying vindicated and or by the Spirit. Because he has said it more fully in his earlier writing in Romans chapter 1. Okay? And so I think we need to recognize that one of the reasons for the resurrection, not only to cause him to be alive, but we might have his righteousness and we might be united to him in his resurrection, both here and now, the new life and the life to come, a glorified body, is because of his resurrection. But I want you to know that the Apostle Paul does say that it's a declaration of power of who he is by the Holy Spirit. And that's what I think he's saying here. First of all, he is manifest in the flesh. Obviously, manifest means being made known. So it may not only indicate he becomes incarnate, but in becoming incarnate, he is being seen as the Son of God already, even though he's not recognized as such. But that's just language that goes back to John's Gospel and elsewhere, particularly John's Gospel, but also in several places in Paul's writing as well. For example, in two places, in 2 Timothy 1:10 and Titus 1:3, and then 1 Peter, Hebrews, 1 John, and elsewhere, but the situation about in the flesh is most clearly indicated by John 1:14, but you should also look at Philippians 2, 7, and 8, as well as him being argued to be the second Adam. The second one has come with human flesh and now is setting up the new race, which will inherit his righteousness, in both Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. So the manifestation of Christ takes place, therefore, by means of the incarnation. And the most explicit place of talking about he must take human flesh, Hebrews 2, 14, 15, and 17. So he's manifested or made known in the flesh. And then he's vindicated by the Spirit. Now I think you can use the word vindicated here for a word that we historically and almost uniformly translated as justified, because that's exactly the way the word is used by the Apostle Paul in Romans 3, 4. And you need to look at Romans 3, 4 so you feel comfortable with that. In Romans 3, 4, we read this, does their faithlessness, I'm reading the end of verse 3, does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though every one were a liar. As it is written, you may be justified in your words. Now justified there means vindicated in your words. And prevail when you are judged. Even though it's translated justified here, it is certainly not means you are going to be declared righteous in your words. Although you could say that in another sense. It means that what you're saying is found to be true, even though what human beings say may be found to be unrighteous. And notice how it goes on. But if our unrighteousness serve to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? So I think you have it in there. You have it in the Gospel's usage also. Matthew 11 and Luke 7. So I think it's appropriate way to read it. Are we about ready?
All right.
Now, we'll stop right here.